What we did was sit down and figure out how we could still achieve our objectives and be responsive to criticisms.
Lawmakers consider a new version of a controversial permitting bill. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, confused about who really has the Iditarod lead? So are the mushers.
Iditarod's like this vibe of forward and back, and you're never really ahead of anyone, are you?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
After sitting in limbo for nearly a year, a controversial permitting bill is on the move in the legislature again. Governor Sean Parnell introduced House Bill 77 last session, and he pitched it as a way of reducing the permitting backlog. But tribal organizations, fishing groups, and environmental outfits came out strongly against it. They argued it would limit public involvement in land management decisions and give the Natural Resources Commissioner blanket authority to issue general permits. Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash says a new version of the bill will be released on Monday, and some of the more contentious provisions have been removed.
What we did was sit down and figure out how it is we could still achieve our objectives and be responsive to those criticisms.
Balash says DNR will still be allowed to issue general permits for a wide variety of human activity, but those permits will get public notice and there will be an opportunity to appeal the initial permit. He says the new draft also allows individuals to apply for water reservations, which are usually used to protect fish habitat.
We sat down and really mapped out, okay, what's our problem? Our problem is that it isn't that individuals are applying for reservations. That's not the problem. The real problem is that those applications are being turned around and used as a reason to stop all other permitting.
Balash says the process surrounding water reservations will be changed. He says if the bill passes, water right applications would no longer block other permits and temporary uses of water. The bill has already passed the House, but was unable to get enough votes in the Senate in its current form. Last year, HB 77 stalled in part because of a vocal group of opponents. People packed town hall meetings to tell their legislators to fight it, and tribes across the state passed resolutions asking for a no vote. But how widespread was that opposition? The Hays Group released a poll this week that gauges public sentiment on the bill. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez joins us to walk us through the numbers. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So what did the poll determine?
Most people don't even know what it does. I've got the poll in front of me, and it says that only 15% of people they called had heard of the bill, let alone know what's in it. But the people who have been tracking it don't like it. Nearly half of those people who are familiar with the legislation strongly oppose it, while another 10% just sort of oppose it. Less than a quarter of people surveyed said they're in favor of the bill, which is about the same amount of people who said they had no opinion at all.
Alexandra, Alaska is notoriously difficult to poll. Can you tell us a little bit about how it was conducted?
The survey was commissioned by Trout Unlimited, a conservation group focused on fish habitat, and they project a 4% margin of error. The poll was done over the phone, and this includes cell phones, back in February, and about 500 likely voters were surveyed. The Hays Group asked people for their party affiliations, and about a third were Republicans and another third were independents. Just 15% were Democrats, and the rest identified as other or they refused to say. As far as the language of the survey goes, it's pretty straightforward when dealing with people who already know what the bill does. But if you're a respondent who has never heard of AB 77, you get the bill described to you in really simple terms. Remember, it's a super, super complicated bill, and the poll sums it up this way. House Bill 77 is designed to allow government officials to issue development permits more quickly by taking away some public participation opportunities from Alaskans. After hearing that phrasing, nearly 70% of respondents say they oppose the bill. Now, if HB 77 had been described as something that streamlines the permitting process, to borrow the Parnell administration's terminology, the results might be a little different.
Does the poll get into whether voters will punish or support lawmakers who come out in favor of HB 77?
So that's one of the most interesting things about this poll, I think. The Hays Group didn't ask people if they would punish their own sitting legislators if they voted for or against it. I mean, remember, this is something that affects a state legislature, not Washington, D.C. However, the only person they asked about was Senate candidate Dan Sullivan, who was commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources when this bill was originally introduced. The poll asks, how likely are you to support Dan Sullivan after knowing that he was the primary author and supporter of House Bill 77? And the results for that are, you know, for about a third of people, which was the highest number, it makes no difference at all. But it does make about 40% less likely to support him and about 10% more likely to support him, according to this poll. Now, the reason I think that's interesting is because so far, Dan Sullivan hasn't really been attacked on his record. In ads that are airing on TV, they've mostly been focused on residency. So to see something like this in this poll, it makes me wonder if we're going to see some advertisements related to HB 77 when it comes to Dan Sullivan's campaign.
Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reporting from Juneau. The commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says the issue of liability for future sulfalane spills should not preclude Flint Hills from selling its North Pole refinery. Speaking in Fairbanks yesterday, Larry Hardig said the state's stance that Flint Hills is responsible for the contamination from spills of the industrial solvent does not include potential future releases.
We wouldn't be going after them for new contamination. There's not even a legal basis to do that.
A Flint Hills official told the state this week that the future liability issue prevents the company from selling the refinery it plans to shut down this summer. Hardig, who's an attorney, said contaminated properties are regularly sold without sellers assuming liability for future spills. Hardig said existing on-site wells and other monitoring are sufficient to determine if there's a new spill. Big Lake musher Martin Boozer is leading the Iditarod. After choosing an unconventional checkpoint for his 24-hour layover early in the race, he charged to the front of the race today. He's now nearing the Nulato checkpoint with Sonny Lindner, Allie Zirkel, and Jeff King in pursuit. Iditarod mushers and their dog teams passed in and out of the Yukon River community of Galena on various schedules throughout the afternoon. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Martin Boozer was the first to take off out of the second checkpoint along the Yukon River. As he put booties on his dogs, he teased Aaron Burmeister about his howling team.
Hey, you gotta breed a little better eaters there, Aaron. You gotta breed some better eaters.
Burmeister's team was barking for food as the no musher scooped a combination of kibble and meat into their bowls.
It's really nice to see it yourself and empty out two coolers right when you get here and get it into them. Plus 20 pounds of dog food and about 20 pounds of meat, so that's their first meal. They ate enough calories to get them to Uniclete already.
His run hasn't been easy. His knee is shredded. It's a combination of a torn ACL, MCL, and meniscus.
On a lot of sharp turns, if there's a tree in front of me, I tip the sled over so I don't run into it, because I can't steer the sled. I can't use my right leg to swivel like I usually do driving a sled, so it's easier just to tip the sled over and then pull it around the tree.
Burmeister says he was 2 hours ahead of schedule coming into Galena. Allie Zirkel says her plan is also playing out well.
My plan was to try not to run them any longer than 8.5 hours, 9 hours, to keep their run slow so their speed would stay high. That was the plan. I don't know if it's going to work. But
Zirkle says she's puzzled by Martin Boozer's plan to run long and rest short. She's likely to chase, but she'll also keep an eye over her shoulder.
Just because everyone's constantly flowing, I did draw this vibe of forward and back, and you're never really ahead of anyone, are you? When they could just stop, put the pedal to the metal, and catch up to you.
The trail is hard and fast along the river, so mushers will likely hold teams back as they near the Bering Sea coast. That's where many of them expect a much more challenging trail. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Galena.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, big dreams for lower power costs in Yakutat.
This might be huge. That's what I'm hoping. You know, if we can harness some of the kinetic energy out of the ocean, it could change the face of power generation for the world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
48 communities in rural Alaska, including 26 in the YK Delta, will receive 3 or 4G data service thanks to an FCC grant of $41 million that GCI has secured. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
GCI's David Morris says the money comes from tribal mobility funds. It's a one-time opportunity for underserved populations.
You know, it's one of those things, what happened at the FCC level, that, you know, you didn't expect, you wouldn't have expected it had happened, and we're just happy that we were able to take advantage of it and bring some better technology out in your direction.
GCI doesn't have the specifics of when the communities will see upgrades, but it will take a few years.
We still have to go through a few more administrative steps before we can say with certainty when the build schedule starts.
They are expected to take 2 years to build out 3G and 4 years for 4G services once the administrative approvals come through. The service will expand off of the Terra Southwest fiber optic and microwave towers, plus satellite, where that's still in use.
But if you're on terrestrial Terra, it's going to go much faster than it will over satellite. But in any event, going from a 2G data platform, which is what you have in rural Alaska today, to 3G or 4G will be a significant advancement.
In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Petersburg School District has won 3 statewide awards for technology and education. As KFSK's Angela Denning reports, the district and the community have made computer learning a priority.
Petersburg is a fishing town of 3,000 on an island in southeast Alaska. But inside the middle school, it's pretty high-tech. As these 7th graders enter their computer class, they pull laptops off a shelf and settle into desks. The class is teaching them how to navigate Google programs, and it's mandatory if they're going to get their own laptops when they enter high school. It's this dedication to technology that caught the attention of the statewide group, Alaska Society for Technology and Education. Dr. Mark Stanley is president of the organization and a professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. He says no one at ASTE can remember one school winning so many annual awards.
We're calling it the Petersburg Sweep.
The district's 3 awards were presented at ASTE's statewide conference in Anchorage, February 25th. Stanley says the sweep reflects on the district's strong team of educators.
You're seeing the effect of, the results of, Petersburg investment over the years and the smart integration of technology and student work.
The district's technology support teacher, John Clute Painter, won an award, as did student P.K. Bunyi for building a quadcopter from scratch and then using it to create an aerial movie called A Simple Walk to School. Superintendent Thomason won the Alaska Technology Administrator of the Year. He's been an educator for over 4 decades.
And in all those years, 43 years, 5 states, 2 foreign countries, this district, with this staff and this technology director, the top of the top.
The school district follows the belief that technology is a good tool for educators to use and an important skill base for students to learn. And classes use it a lot. Kids have access to computer devices from kindergarten on. All high school students have their own laptops 24/7. And Clute Painter, along with an assistant, makes sure they're all running smoothly.
Just checked this morning, we had about 500 devices connected to our Wi-Fi network, all doing multiple things.
But technology only works if people know how to use it. Clute Painter says it's mission critical to what the Petersburg schools do. The district prioritizes real-time needs first, addressing students and staff immediately. Say there's a website that's not accessible because the school's content filter has prevented a class from using it.
Maybe the teacher's lesson is hinging on that, and you have 20 students waiting to access something, then it's blocked. And so those sorts of things, you have to react quickly.
You know, when John talks about opening up a site, it used to be a three-week process.
Again, Superintendent Thomason.
You had to go through a whole bunch of justifications, and now it's more, here's what I want to do, here's why I need to do it, I'm in the middle of a lesson, it happens right now.
It's basically helping the users use the equipment.
They call it three-click stupid, in the sense that you just need it to work. And if it doesn't work in a number of clicks, then people won't use it. And we've invested way too much just to have things collect dust.
The district's relationship with technology began about 10 years ago when it was awarded a grant for high school laptops called One-to-One. The students are prepped for it in middle school with classes such as digital citizenship. It's this kind of forward thinking that has made this small town an example for how technology can enhance learning with the right dedication. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Representative Bill Stoltz, a Republican from Chugiak, announced a new political path at the Matsu Senior Center in downtown Palmer today.
After serving in the House of Representatives, I am going to ask your permission and going through a job interview and ask to be your new state senator. It's an open house seat.
Stoltz told the audience that his heart has always been in Palmer, and now he'd like to represent that city in a new state Senate district. He said he'd done a lot of soul searching before making the announcement. Stoltz told reporters later there'd be no looking back.
I'm in it to win it, and if I don't win, I go to be a private citizen again.
Stoltz has already represented Palmer's Lazy Mountain and Springer Loop precincts for more than a decade. His district will take on downtown Palmer and some of the city's surrounding area. And he says he has the support of the Valley's political contingent.
I've met with all of them, Wes and Mark and Shelley and Charlie and Mike, and they're all very enthusiastic about it.
Stoltz has served on the House Finance Committee since 2003. He was the committee's vice chair for two terms and co-chair for three terms.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Foreman. This week on AK, wave energy. Ocean waves do more than knock your boat around and carry trash to shore. The same force can power devices that generate electricity. Yakutat is gearing up for a wave energy experiment that could help it and other coastal cities lower power costs. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld traveled to the eastern Gulf of Alaska city to learn more about it.
Scott Newland opens the door to Yakutat's new power plant. It's not so bad outside the sound-absorbing walls, and that's good news for Newland, who's headed up Yakutat's power system for 15 years.
That new plant just changed the whole atmosphere, especially where I'm living right next door to it.
Its generators run more efficiently, and Newland's proud of that. But power costs in Yakutat remain high.
Since I've been involved here, that's always been a goal, is to find a different source of energy other than diesel fuel.
These days, he's thinking about a power source with a different sound.
Wave energy is probably the most exciting thing we have going.
Yakutat's geography doesn't work for hydro. Weather limits what you can get out of solar and wind. Wood-fueled biomass got serious consideration, but with only 450 electrical customers, it doesn't have the efficiencies of scale. That's why the town is looking toward the ocean. A number of emerging technologies are available. Some use anchored buoys, others long lines of floats. Yakutat's trying out a smaller device called the Surge Wave Converter, made by Boston-based Resolute Marine Energy. It's sort of like a paddle hinged to a base on the ocean floor. Here's how Newland describes it.
It reminds me of a kelp frond in the water as waves go by, and it sways back and forth like that. It's that slow and that mild.
The back and forth movement powers a pump, which pushes water through pipes to the shore. That pressure is the carbon-free energy that runs an electrical generator. Resolute Marine has tested the Surge at a North Carolina research facility. Yakutat planner Bill Lucy says it's time to try it out in the Gulf of Alaska.
We know it makes electricity. It survived an East Coast storm. So now what we need to know is how much is it going to cost to anchor them to the bottom so they don't bounce around in a West Coast storm.
Yakutat hoped to put a test unit in the water this year. If it worked, it would have added about a dozen more later on. But permitting and other delays pushed that back to 2015. So the job now for Lucy and others is to research possible impacts to the community and the environment.
Since we're not going to be generating electricity underwater, there probably won't be an issue with the fish. Usually what can happen is your sharks and your rays can become attracted to underwater cables. But this project will simply pump pressurized seawater to a shore-based plant, and the electricity will be generated on land.
He says seabirds aren't expected to be an issue since the system's underwater. Acoustic tests will look for impacts on whales and seals. Commercial fisheries are being taken into account, and then there's the surfers, attracted by the same ocean power that makes this project a possibility.
There's a lot of beach break all along that area, and if we put 14 of these panels out, it's not going to take out all the wave areas for surfing, and it might not even be an issue where they are.
Funding and technical help for this testing phase is coming from the federal, state, and local governments. Early estimates put the final cost at about $3 million, but it could be much higher. Borough manager Skip Ryman hopes it'll pencil out, but he's trying to be realistic.
The big question is, of course, is wave energy feasible? Is it going to be something that will actually aid the consumer? If wave energy proves to be more expensive than diesel, then certainly this is something that probably throw it under the bus for us.
It'll take a couple years till that's known. Back at the power plant, Newland remains optimistic.
This might be huge. That's what I'm hoping. You know, if we can harness some of the kinetic energy out of the ocean, it could change the face of power generation for the world.
Or at least for some other coastal Alaska communities. For AK, this is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Yakutat.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Tok, where the community is coming together to rebuild a home for a family that lost everything in a recent fire.
Hi, my name is John Rushniak. I'm the president of the Tok Chamber of Commerce. I've lived in Tok area for the last 24 years, and I'm proud to be a resident of this community. Recently, actually December 1st, we had a house fire with a young family, a mom and two young children. And the reason I'm proud of that is because the community is pulled together, and we are just about finished building her a cabin. The community and residents in the state of Alaska have generated, donated nearly $30,000 to build this cabin, and laborers have given hours of time to put this together. So it's kind of a a community where we quite often are very independent and do our own things, but when push comes to shove and we need to help one another, people are more than generous to give of their time, money, and effort. The family that had the fire was a young mom, about 35 years old, a daughter, 7 years old, and a son, 5 years old. The daughter was first aware of the fire in her bedroom during the middle of the night and came screaming to her mom, "There's a fire in my bedroom." And it was 41 below that night, and the mom left everything in the house, cell phone and everything, to get the kids out, and got into a car that wasn't plugged in, and at 41 below it started, and she drove to her uncle's house to call the fire department, but by then the house was lost. She grew up in this area. As a child, we knew her mom and dad, and they moved away after the dad died, and she came back just this last summer to rebuild her dad's house, to raise her own children in this community, and when the fire hit, her dreams kind of went up in smoke. So it's kind of neat the way the community's pulled together and organized the rebuilding of her dream.
John Rushniak is president of the Tok Chamber of Commerce. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Schoenfeld, Ann Hillman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Foreman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Galena, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Get away and stay in AK at UAS Juneau, small enough that your professors know you by name, big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new residence hall opening fall of 2014. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.